Despite his talents as an auctioneer, Richard Dance took a bit of persuading to sit down and record a podcast for the Carriage Commentator. But still on the crest of a wave after a successful Reading carriage sale in early April, the time was right to get Richard to open up about his career at Thimbleby in Shoreland, which started 41 years ago after his father answered an advert on the back of the sale report for an auctioneer's assistant. Richard is now the managing director of Thimbleby in Shoreland and has overseen changes in the business, moving away from being mainly agricultural and equestrian to specialising in contractors, plant and machinery and fine art, and bringing the live auctions online. But he loves the traditions and is working hard to maintain the Reading carriage sales for the driving world and his many friends. Enjoy this light-hearted chat between a husband and wife who, despite their best efforts, fell for each other a long time ago in Reading Market. So it's Easter weekend here in the Dance household in North Hampshire, and it's a few days on from what was a very successful Reading carriage sale on the 1st of April. And so it seemed an apt time to have a chat to the managing director, is that your formal title at Thimbleby in Shoreland, and also my husband, Richard Dance. Richard, how did you feel the sale went on Wednesday?
Very pleased with it in the main. It belied a little bit of the preamble about where the trade was and what the trade was doing, but with a collection like we had on Wednesday and the support and the popularity of the collection, people paid just to have a bit of a memory, which has certainly helped the trade along.
So we're referring to the collection that was very sadly for sale due to the untimely death of Ben Turner, who was a friend of ours as well as being a client. And the Turner family had been clients of Thimbleby and Shoreland on the farming side for many years, hadn't they?
Yeah, over 40, yeah.
So it really was quite a shock when he had his accident. And although these sorts of sales are sad, and it's never easy for the estate and the executors and the family, and we're very sensitive to that at Thimbleby and Shoreland, they do generate quite a buzz, and it's like a good funeral. It's rather sad that the person, which we're all talking about and focused on, wasn't to see actually how popular and highly regarded he was. I mean, everybody had a Ben story, and that generated a lot of interest around the sale of not just his carriages, but the harness and his models sold well, all his bits and pieces. What was your feeling about it? Because you were selling all the carriages that day.
Well, any sale that has a good collection in it always attracts more interest and more entries. I mean, certainly entries were bumped up when news came out that Ben's estate was being sold, and it certainly attracted more entries, which in itself attracted a lot more buyers and a lot more lookers. You know, the trade these days is not where it was in the heyday, but to have a sale like that and to have the interest still in it shows that there is definitely a future. And as long as everybody supports and we keep fighting to hold the sale, we'll keep going from here.
So to go back to the beginning, the sales were founded in the early 1960s on the strength of John Major being approached by the late George Mossman to sell the collection of carriages and bits and pieces that he'd bought from the British Lion Film Studios and the director Alexander Corder when carriages tended to be supplied in-house a bit more. But he also had some bits and pieces from the Royal Mews. And John came to the firm in the 1950s, didn't he? And he was at one of our chartered surveyors. But he also didn't know one end of a horse from another, but was passionate about old cars, so instantly fell in love with carriages and all the history around them. And after he'd had that sale, I think it was 1962, wasn't it? He spent a couple of years researching, did all sorts of, you say 1965?
Possibly.
Well, anyway, one of us will get our facts straight. And he spent a couple of years going off and researching, meeting people. He was quite thorough and fastidious, wasn't he? And read everything he could about carriages so that he maintained, and I know it's something you believe in as well, that the auctioneer must always be one of the most knowledgeable people in the room about what they're selling. But John certainly, and that's something he passed on to me, felt that if you are standing up selling something, you really must know about it, particularly something as specialist as carriages. But what's your feeling on that?
Well, that's why we have to rely on a lot of people out there with a lot of knowledge, because sadly, you know, as you say, the sale started in the 60s. We're years and years on from that now. And sadly, a lot of the characters and a lot of the knowledge has now gone and has died. And the sales wouldn't carry on without the support of those that are in the know. It's not the sort of thing that you deal with and trade with every day of the week. It is a sale that now only happens twice a year. We've come down from 5 to 2. And if you're not on it all the time, you can lose track of where the trade is.
But that's down to all sorts of things, not least social media, because people can just put a carriage for nothing on Facebook and it's sold. Back in the day, if you wanted to trade in carriages or anything to do with driving globally, you had to come to Reading. That there just weren't these other outlets. It's hard to think. I mean, even back in the day, doing a telephone bid was quite advanced, and using faxes. We used to get all our faxes through from people like Paul Martin in America with reserves or purchases. It really was a very different era, wasn't it?
It's less of a specialist commodity these days, like anything, whether it was the first bull that came in from the continent or the first European pig that came in, thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds to start with. And when it gets more commercial, more people trade. And as you say, with the birth of the internet, it is very, very easy. You're talking about fax machines, but when I was there before you, we still have our telex machine. The telex machine was how we got messages to and fro. No mobile phones, pigeon post. I mean, to get an to see a client, to write to them and to have an answer back, it was a 2-week turnaround. I mean, it's a 40-second turnaround now. By the time you've messaged, you can get photographs online, you can upload them to the cloud, you can download them. But at the end of the day, it's still a very long process to get all the information in one catalogue, all correct. And at the end of the day, you can't please everybody.
No, but that's just people, and horsey people in particular. We say that tongue in cheek. But the structure of the sale has changed, because back in the day when I took over, we had obviously the carriage section and then the trailers and horse boxes at the back. And that was a very separate section from the harness that Michael used to start selling. And then in a separate section, John Holland, they were the senior partners when I joined in the early 90s. John would be down selling was the carriage parts.
Well, going taking off that, when there used to be 150 carriages was the maximum, when we used to be able to open the whole of the market up, there would be 30 or 40 on the waiting list when I started in the mid-80s. And one of the best supported sections that John Holland loved was the parts section. And sadly, that's one part of the sale that isn't as popular as it was. But there used to be 3 auctioneers selling the carriages. There always used to be, well, Dick Long, my old pal Dick Long, the old senior partner, who took over 2 years after I started. Took over as senior partner 2 years after I started. Me and him were always made to go outside and sell the exercise vehicles and all the farm carts in the rain. And then always remember that lot 61, John Major always used to take over, and that was, tell a lie, lot 30, John Major used to take over, nicely covered up, all the decent carriages in the next 30, 35 lots that John Major saw. And when all the good ones had finished, Michael Kimber had to finish off towards the end of the sale.
Yes,
and
I do
sell
remember
the stuff.
That.
And John, you know, John Major was the knowledge, put all the work in. And as any auctioneer will tell you, if you put the sale together and you put the work in, you deserve to sell the prime lots.
Well, he did. And he had quite a particular selling style. But something that I got rid of with everybody's blessing was his flipping shopping trolley. Do you remember how long it used to take to construct that? It was a shopping trolley.
I helped him build that, I'll have you know. Thank you very much.
With the speakers sticking out. And he used to move it round. And I think it was part of his mental ritual getting ready was him constructing it, because
but don't forget that was modern technology at the time.
It was pinched from one of the shops up on Friars Street.
He did try to take it. In his defense, he tried to take it back to three supermarkets, and in the end he thought, stuff that, if they don't want it back, I'll keep it. But when we first built it and we put the poles up to have the PA working, we didn't realise quite how top-heavy it was, so we had to go out and pinch a 56-pound weight to put under it because the shopping trolley kept falling over.
So I was quite pleased when we moved on to, actually it was from Peter Walker, I remember we bought the first proper sound system, NSR, Peter, who supplies so many sound systems around the shows the length and breadth of the country. And that was quite interesting. And that was a real moment when it was plugged in and we weren't relying on car batteries and things. It was quite funny. And then John had his trolley that he used to move around. He'd sell three carriages at a time, and actually pushing the trolley through, which is something we both did as well, through the crowds.
Very time consuming.
Which was why it was such a brilliant initiative on Wednesday, whereby you had the rostrum at the top end of the market, like I used to do in that middle room, and just sold from one place with a screen behind you. And that worked brilliantly, didn't it?
Well, we moved the carriages from when you were there, don't forget. Yeah. All the carriages used to be under the cover. But with the way the trade has gone and we don't have animals in there, we removed a lot of pens, which cleared up a nice, brighter space for the carriages. And trying to get through a crowd, because the sales are still so well attended, it's very difficult to get through the crowd. And you know, as nice as you can be, there are always people that haven't seen each other for months and months that are midway through a conversation and don't actually hear you approaching from behind. And it works so much better. The feedback in the main that we've had from most people was that it was very good with the big screen and the picture up behind. There was no getting away from what was being sold.
Well, what was brilliant, and obviously it was behind you so you couldn't see, but the chap who was working the laptop behind the rostrum.
Oh, the online platform.
Which was the online platform, because whilst you were selling live and taking bids from the room, there was also people bidding online, plus there were phone bids and commission bids. So essentially there's almost bids coming in from four different directions sometimes. So you have to be, I mean, you are famously sharp, and it is your superpower being an auctioneer, but you have to be even more alert, don't you, to make sure you're not missing anything.
Well, you can't, well, you know as well as I do, you can't watch everything at one time. If you watch the crowd, the internet goes, then you keep your eye on the screen and somebody shouting you in the crowd and sort of tongue-in-cheek way having a go because you've missed them, yet you've looked at them three times, they haven't moved. As soon as you look away, they go. And that is why you need your support of your staff, you need the support of loyal customers and friends that will be good enough to point out a bid. Other bidders aren't so good at pointing out other bids if they happen to be in, but in the main, and I don't think any bid was missed at all on Wednesday.
No, because the increments were going up behind you. So the big picture of the lot being sold, and this again is another way the sales have changed in more recent history, although you'd brought it in before the pandemic, was that every lot where possible is photographed, so that people, although we recommend, particularly when buying carriages from a safety point of view, if nothing else, that they've seen them in person, people do see the illustrations beforehand. Because when John and I were running the sales, we were by and large reliant on the information supplied to us via entry forms and from the clients, although we spent a huge amount of time going and visiting people and collecting the information. Most of the lots, the information came in on handwritten entry forms. Now, because you're providing this platform where the catalogue is live, say 2 weeks before the sale, and all the lots are illustrated, not just the carriages like it was back in the day, but the other lots as well, it enables you to have this online bidding platform, and it really has transformed things completely.
Well, that's why we still do, funnily, we still work very much getting the catalogue up from scratch from entry forms. There isn't the travelling around. We do ask to see pictures before. Some vendors are better photographers than others, and some of them, quite frankly, are completely lousy. But anything that comes in where we feel the photograph that's been supplied to us doesn't do justice, we always try and create a better photograph. But at the end of the day, a photograph is a photograph, and the majority of purchasers want to come, touch, feel, and see what they're buying. A photograph can look very good at times, although you try to get across an honest opinion of what you've got of in the sunshine. A nice shiny carriage doesn't always look like that when you're up close, but it's a much longer-winded process than it used to be. The entry forms used to come in, you do a catalogue, it was writing. I grant you, there were photographs of the carriages on separate pages. All the photographs are with each lot now. Those catalogues back, the catalogues then only had black and white photographs in to start with, but it is a very, very long-winded process trying to get everything online and all the information together on the online platform. And that is where we have to rely on our superbly dedicated team. Claire put a fantastic amount of work into doing the catalogue, and I don't think many people appreciate quite what time and effort goes into. I didn't quite appreciate how much time she was spending on the catalogue, and still rely on your help, Sarah, and we still very much rely on Chris Boren to come and help, and another colleague of mine, Truman. They put in a phenomenal amount of work just to make the sale happen, and it is quite a few moment when the sale is finished, because if you have a good sale and there was good mood and there was buoyancy in the trade, it is very much a feel-good factor. But without the hard work, as in any job, it doesn't happen without the true dedication of a good team, which I'm very lucky to have.
And it's Swan Syndrome, isn't it? Whilst you're aiming for everything to look smooth, but then you have to roll your sleeves up. We're both from farming backgrounds, as are quite a majority of the people from Thimbleby and Shoreditch, from that sort of work ethic where it's not a 9-to-5 job and it doesn't matter what day of the week is. If the job's got to be done, it's got to be done. And that's been the backbone of the business. But you are doing, sadly for you, because you're such a good auctioneer, far less live auctions now, because at least as the managing partner at Thimbleby and Shoreditch, or managing director now, it's not a partnership anymore, you had the initiative to put a lot of your machinery sales online. So thankfully, when the pandemic came, you weren't caught short like a lot of auction firms, because you already had the system in place.
Without being seen to be contradicting completely, the pandemic came along and it changed us. I can't claim to it being our decision. It certainly changed businesses and a lot of auctioneering businesses. There were still some auctioneers that carried on. We weren't quite sure how that happened, because an auctioneer's remit is to get the biggest crowd in possible to get the best trade for what you've got on sale. And you are not allowed to get anybody in. A carry sale was the only sale that did not work online. We haven't had a plant or machinery sale live since the pandemic. We haven't had a furniture sale live since the pandemic. And we tried an online sale with the carriages. Soulless. That everybody wants a meeting place. A carriage sale isn't just a sale. A carriage sale is a meeting place for old friends. And unfortunately, we create a car park for people to trade in, which we're not too keen on. But it does happen, and people like to get together. And I do miss selling. I very much miss the live selling. I thoroughly enjoyed it on Wednesday. But do I miss selling in driving snow or the weather that's coming in this weekend, 90 mile an hour winds, ankle deep in water in the middle of February? No, I don't these days, 40 years in.
Because let's not beat around the bush. It's absolutely exhausting selling. And by the time you would start at one of your big Hewden's or contractor's plant sale, you'd put in weeks of really hard graft and long hours to get to that point. The night before a carriage sale, I was often there till 10, 11 o'clock at night. You're in there at sort of 5 o'clock in the morning. You're running on adrenaline. And then the next day, the lights are on, but nobody's in, because it is a very, very draining.
We always call the day after it. It's never collection day the day after. It's train wreck day.
Because
you get that. And the worst thing about auctioneering when you have a very big, very difficult sale is you've put all your energy, as you say, getting into getting the catalogue ready, making sure it is right, making sure that it is presented well. You've done everything you need to do. You've had the viewing. You've dotted every I, you've crossed every T, and you are physically exhausted, and you just have to draw on some more mental strength to get yourself through the auctioneering. But any auctioneer, the first 5 or 10 minutes, it's like when you're exercising. Once you've done the 5 minute warm up, you sort of forget where you are, and it happens naturally. But the day after, with so much concentration and having to sell for, I think the longest I've done, 7 or 8 hours in one stint, it's very hard work. And the day after is more difficult than actually selling when you're tired.
It is. But your top price on Wednesday was £41,000 for a gypsy wagon. And that was, as we say, man to man.
For the bow top.
It's just a term for the bow top, people bidding against each other.
There was a phone bid, there was a commission bid, and there were four people in the crowd bidding. And a lot of interest.
It was beautiful. It was the last lot in Ben's collection from the carriages. And you'd had quite a few people talking to you beforehand, and there was quite a lot of brinkmanship because the guy who ended up buying it, we won't reveal names, had spent quite a lot of time saying, oh, but this and that, and, you know, trying to find fault. And you knew fine well he was going to buy it. He was just trying to put other people off, wasn't he?
You will never have a buyer, a potential buyer, telling you something is better than we think it is. I did ask him if he wanted to have a closer look at it, see it actually had a flat tire as well as everything else. He told me wasn't quite right about it.
Wooden wheels, yes.
And then, miracle upon miracles, it sells particularly well. And if two people want it, no valuer in the world can judge a trade.
Well, it's lovely because that's you've mentioned a word that really is so key to being a professional auctioneer, and that's value. And a good auctioneer, we used to say this about John Holland in particular, who was also a brilliant auctioneer, can look at anything. I'm looking outside at some garden furniture and things. You get a feeling, you get an instinct, and you shut your eyes and you look at something and you think about the figure that comes into your head. Because particularly with the carriages, because we were the specialists, we were the market, we set the trade as much as anything. So you had, when people would come along with probably something that was quite unique, it wasn't like, do you remember the miller's guides where you could look up and see what silver had made for years? There was nothing like that. So you just had to go on gut instinct as much as anything, didn't you?
Well, with most other things that are sold, you have something else to compare it with. Many carriages. I know you have individual pictures and you have individual cars, but there are things very similar mileage, similar age, similar colour, similar condition. Sometimes you will find a carriage that is completely unique that nobody has ever sold before. You have to have what John and I always called a gut reaction.
Yeah.
And more often than not, that is where you want to stick. Because 9 times out of 10, invariably, you might not be absolutely right, but you're pretty damn close.
So we're going to go back to Richard the Boy, who's a local farmer's son, second of three sons, who went to a boarding school not far from here.
Loved it.
Didn't enjoy being in the classroom. You've got a very, very good brain, but it's not an academic one necessarily. And you just wanted to get out and play rugby and cricket, didn't you? You were sport mad, the whole family is, but you in particular. And I think the education system back then wasn't well suited to a boy like you who had packets of energy, but just didn't quite know what to do with it. So you left school, then went to college in Basingstoke. But it was quite clear from the family.
Sometimes I went to school.
Sometimes
college for Basingstoke.
You were playing a lot of rugby for Basingstoke and Henley then, weren't you? And your father made it quite clear. He was a dairy farmer, pig farmer. He had a very big enterprise as a tenant farmer on the Stratfield Say estate, that there simply wasn't a place for you on the farm.
That was a shock to me. That was a shock to me when I thought, because there was no point doing resits or doing it. It didn't matter to me where Outer Mongolia was on the map, because I was always going to go and milk cows and go into farming. And then when I finished my education, he said, right, that's it, you need to find a job now, because there's certainly no future in dairy farming as a tenant farmer on one of the four local estates. And I thought, oops, now he tells me 7 years down the line. And luckily, after a market, a report was sent round, and you'd have anything, the cattle prices, pig prices, sheep prices for the day were in the report, and on the back would be hay for sale or store cattle or when the next sale is, and a little writing at the bottom, auctioneer's assistant. And luckily, he said to me, there's a job you can do. And he got me the interview. We were always Simmons and Sons, Simmons and Lawrence, as they were then, clients, had never heard of Thimbleby and Shoreland, didn't have a clue who they were, and went to go and have an interview with Michael Kimber on a Saturday morning. And he said, when can you start? I said, well, I need to give Dad a week's notice. I'd like to have a week off before I start. And of course, typically I finished at 10 o'clock on the Sunday night before I start. And I started bank holiday Monday. Every Monday was worked. It was a bank holiday Monday market. And I thought, oh, this is quite good, because we were sent home at about 1:30 when everything finished. And I thought, oh, this is better than dairy farming. But things rapidly changed, and that was as busy as anything. But I'm very, very lucky to have fallen on my feet and find something that it turned out I was able to do.
Well, you didn't know, and none of us know. Nobody ever sets out or is told at school or by a careers officer you're going to be an auctioneer.
Nobody ever says when I leave school I want to be an auctioneer that I've heard of.
It's just not a thing, because it's such a specialist career. But how long ago was that? Because we're not far away from that anniversary.
6th of May 1985, 41 years this year.
41 years, and it's actually the 125th anniversary of Thimbleby and Shawland, which was founded in 1901. I'll come to that in a minute, because we had quite an interesting evening with the local farming group when we were touring the market and talking about that. But I'm really curious, because I don't think anybody would find it a surprise that the young Richard was a bit of a handful, partied quite hard, worked hard.
Wouldn't hear a word of it.
And didn't always turn up to work.
Always turned up to work. Had a full night's sleep, but always turned up to work.
And you just took to it, didn't you? And you were really, actually, both John Major and Dick Long took you under their wing. They saw something in this cheeky chappie that not everybody saw, but they saw your potential and they put a lot of faith in you, didn't they?
Well, I think I understood, because we were very much a farming firm then, I understood farm animals. You know, you knew which end bit and which end the other one. And there were lots of people that came through college, learnt it out of a book, and there's nothing beats a practical education, in my opinion. I certainly learnt more about life in about the first year or 18 months working in the market with the drovers and seeing how the real world actually turned, having been completely blindfolded by being at public school.
Well, it was interesting, because you spoke the other night, and it's somebody who was a big figure in your life and latterly mine a bit, and he wasn't big at all. He was a very short chap, and that was Tommy, but Mr. Gordon Thompson, he was called, wasn't he? And he was the chief drover, and he was an extraordinary character. He had a hunchback, and he physically was quite impaired, but he was tough as nails, and he would work, he would manage the market, he'd manage all the other drovers, and they treated him with so much respect. And he also would flutter regularly on the horses, wouldn't he?
Anything. Horses, greyhounds, he would be betting, and if there wasn't anything on, he'd be flipping 50p's, he'd be spoofing, and he'd be wheeling and dealing. And he did a heck of a line in whiskey and cigarettes from the continent that used to come over with the polo horses used to go over to the continent, and black and white cattle used to come back, and in calf boxes and fuel tanks there was anything from whiskey, cigarettes, and Tommy was the man to go to. And he was a true one-off character.
But he, I mean, there's you coming from a smart farming family, a well-known, the Dancers are a well-known farming family in the area, as were the Perrotts, your mum's side. And then you're dropped into the market, and you have to be one of the lads. And I also say from personal experience, that's quite hard when you come in and you have to roll your sleeves up and you work. And you probably learnt just as much, if not more, from Tommy as you did from people like Kerr Kirkwood and Dick and John.
Oh, certainly. You would. I mean, they were the guys. I mean, they really had to work for a living. You know, if they didn't, it was all, drovers used to go round the country. It used to be Reading on a Monday, Guildford on a Tuesday, Tame on a Wednesday. I can't remember where the others were, but that was where they made their, that was how they made their money. And if they didn't turn up and work, they didn't get paid. And Tommy used to have to organise drovers for a Monday, and Mr. Major would always, I still call him Mr. Major, all these years
on. All these years on.
And he would say, Tommy, I would like 12 people for the carriage sale on Wednesday. I'd like 3 on Tuesday, 4 on Thursday to see these carriages out. And Tommy always used to do it.
He found the staff, didn't he?
He always found the staff, and people never let him down. He used to find the slip runners. He used to find the security. And those people and drovers don't really exist so much anymore. Well, certainly around this area.
Well, there aren't as many markets open. It's not such an agricultural area.
We're not an
area.
Agricultural area at all.
I mean, how many, we talked about this the other night, how many dairy farms?
Well, there was talk, I think when I was talking to John Holland, we were trying to work out, there were certainly 40, 50, 60 dairy herds on Yattendon, Englefield, Wasing, and Stratfield say, and you literally two or three now.
Yep.
In and my father was absolutely right. A tenant farmer with 120 acres is not going to be able to survive doing dairy cattle.
Well, everybody's had to diversify. But so you started Richard the Lad out in the market, dealing with the calves on a Monday morning. How many different livestock sales were there in a week back then? Because it was one of the main thrusts of the business, wasn't it?
There was Monday market, cattle, pig, sheep, calves. We could have dairy on a Tuesday. But very often after a Monday market, Dick Long and I were always sent out to drive to anywhere, because back then, Thimblebees were still selling every Ayrshire cow that was sold, because under the auspices of the Ayrshire Society, Thimblebee and Shoreland were contracted to sell pedigree Ayrshire cattle. We used to leave the market on a Monday night and we could drive anywhere. It could be Scotland, it could be Cornwall, we used to go to Otley and get ready, and Michael Kimber and Kerr Kirk would used to either drive up or fly up and come and sell the cattle. And then Dick and I used to leave straight after the sale to get back to Reading, because Wednesdays could be carriages, it could be furniture, there would be store cattle on a Friday or horses on a Friday, there'd be a killing market on the Saturday, contractor's plant was on the Thursday. And selling live twice a year now. We used to do it three times a week and twice a year live in the market now.
Well, back in the day, I keep using that term, once upon a time, you were setting record prices for Ayrshires and for the pigs. The pictures on the walls in the office in Great Knollys Street, there were some incredible pig prices back in the day.
I was very young when I went into market, because my father had a huge amount of outdoor sales, along with Brian Thurley, Richard Roadknight, used to fill the market up. But sadly, the rumours about pig trade are true. They're good about once every 7 years. And most pig farmers folded. There are still certainly some about now, but it is a very, very hard way to earn a living. You can never rely on the trade. But then cattle trade at the moment, a good trade for cows back then, but good for fat cattle back then, £500 or £600. I mean, they're £2,500-£3,000 for a bullock now.
Yeah, well, a huge amount goes into it. The farmer's still not making profits. And alongside that, the partners at Thimblebee and Shoreland, we were chartered surveyors. So there was a lot of land agency which was advising farmers dealing in the purchase and sale and land management of all sorts of different countryside pursuits. But there was once a month on a Saturday, we had the furniture sales. Then there was the machinery sales. They ended up amalgamating. But from that, we used to have antique sales in a village hall up near Henley. And probably on the horsey side, which you got pulled into a bit more reluctantly, there was the first Friday of the month was the horse sale, which again had stopped just because that trade fell through.
It was always the sale where last man in had to sell the horses. And you always waited for somebody new to start, teach them how to sell, and then you left the horses to them on the Friday, because none of the partners wanted to sell the horses. It wasn't a nice sale at the end of the day.
But it was also where everybody who was starting out as an auctioneer would go and sell the saddlery lots for
Alan Rich. Betty Purser was there. But then, there aren't the saddlery people. Again, the online facility has taken over all these saddlery shops.
But a sale that you were really involved in for a long time, and again, probably because of the internet and the changed world we live in, were the Shetland sales. And that's something that Thimblebee and Shoreland were founder auctioneers for, the Shetland Pony Society, the stud book sales. And we had one in October. That's what Dick ran. And then there was a spring one.
And the numbers were so great, we had a spring sale. I mean, the trade for Shetlands is still very, very good, but the trade for horses is good at the moment. You can't find any. Trade for cattle is good. The trade for sheep is good. I'm not quite sure where people are finding all this money. It's a shame the trade for carriages isn't on a par with them.
Well, it was on Wednesday. Actually, going through the books, I think if we worked out the figures, there'd be a higher percentage of lots sold than we've had for a very long time.
It was a phenomenon. I mean, yeah. There was a handful of lots not sold, if that.
That was something John always used to do in his sale reports. He would work out the percentage. And if it was favourable, then we'd share it. If not, we'd just keep it quiet. But what really made you as an auctioneer was the advent of the contractor's plant sale. And that was something that John did with there were early figures like John Digan and Phil Matthews, who were really important people to us, Andy Ross as well. But it's we as a firm morphed into doing, generators, heavy plant construction.
There are no farmers as such, or very, very few farmers with equipment. A lot of farmers around the area, but everything is traded in. There aren't the livestock around this area that there is. The amount of construction going on around this area, it just seemed common sense to be selling the machinery to build houses rather than, we still have farm sales. They're certainly going on down towards the West Country, a lot more farmers than there is around Reading. I mean, we're not known as Silicon Valley for nothing really around here, around the Thames Valley.
But that's something you're still drafted in to do quite a lot, is the vintage sales. Thermal Beer Shaw and always did things like vintage tractors and those sorts of things.
We used to pride ourselves on selling everything. John Holland is the only auctioneer, I think, in the country, if not the world, to have sold an elephant's typewriter when we sold up Billy Smart Circus in 1987.
Well, I was going to ask you what were your favourite lots, but the contractors' plant sales, that was something you had a special affinity to. You really took to the machinery side of it, didn't you?
It came on from farm machinery and understanding it, and certainly had a lot of interest in plant. And that's moved on. We never had a forklift when we first started. We used to nip down to John Wilder's, borrow a little Fordson Major that had a forklift attachment on the back for the three lifts we needed. We now run five forklifts 5 days a week because equipment has got so much bigger. Unfortunately, our yard hasn't got any bigger. We sort of outgrown where we are in Reading, but we pack it in. The lads that run the plant sales certainly do a superb job of getting everything in, and it's now very nearly an open yard all the time. Used to be a week in, week out, get on with something else. Now it's virtually a full turnaround with five forklifts working. But plant's always been a big favourite of mine, but then selling cranes at nearly £400,000 each was quite interesting. And I sold a racehorse at £87,000, and those are the things you remember.
But the business has obviously had to adapt through time. We talk about the decline of the in-person auctions, apart from for the carriages, and how you've adapted even since COVID with the online sales. And Rob, one of your directors, has really put a huge amount of energy into the fine arts side, which has been brilliant. He's created his own sale room. We had some Ian Fleming Bond memorabilia in the other day, which sold incredibly well. He's done a brilliant job. But as you talk about the premises, I mean, it has become quite a pastime for people to moan about that market, but it has served the business very, very well. It's still owned by Reading Borough Council. They're your landlords and you work quite well with them. There's all sorts of talk about emission zones in Reading, all sorts of things that might...
It's been there since 1850. Nobody really wants to touch the asbestos roof, which doesn't help.
No, but Thermal Beer Shaw was founded in 1901, and you recently did some research into those early days and the people that were involved. It's quite interesting.
Very interesting, looking back with selling the horses after the war and how Thimbleby's got the name. I've told you, we used to sell all the Ayrshire cattle and as very, very much agricultural auctioneers. But then Reading Market, everybody thinks of Reading Market and thinks of Thimbleby and Shoreland. Even back when I started, there were five or six auctioneers still using Reading Cattle Market. Simmons's used to have a separate day for their store cattle. Reading Market Auctions was born out of Thimbleby's and Simmons's sharing the market on the same day with the partners and the staff, touting for business out on the street. And then they thought, well, why don't we just put it all together and just share the profit? So we used to have a store sale on the Friday. A fortnight later, Simmons's would have a store sale on the Friday. There were bull sales in there. The Flying Club used to have pigeons. They used to, all sorts of people. And then gradually, we were the last men standing in the market. And we are the only auctioneers that trade out of Reading now.
Yeah. And you're custodians of it, and the business is shaped around it. Now, you would be the first to say you are not horsey at all, despite your wife and daughters and the world we've created around ourselves. But you do, and I say this about you, do know what makes a good horse, because you've sold more of them than most auctioneers. And you do enjoy the driving or the coaching side. You've made some good friends and had some good fun and adventures on that side of it.
Not much, but you make very good friends with any sale. Every sale without exception, you make a lot of friends as well as clients. But the thing with the sort of Shetland side or the plant side is you don't get a day out drinking champagne on a horse-drawn vehicle.
On the coaches. And at last, we've managed to get you involved in our Royal Windsor Horse Show stewarding team.
Which at last? I've been doing it for years.
Well, your best man is a chap called Andrew Brooks, whose father, Colin, was chairman of the show for a very long time. And Andrew had been trying to persuade you for years to get involved and you resisted. Anyway, when I took on the job, we managed to pull you in and you do enjoy
it. He was easier to resist than you. That was the thing. But it was at him. But once you've mentioned his name, a lot of the hard days at work were his fault because he took me out the night before a big sale sometimes.
He's now managing director of his own company as well. So you've both done pretty well out of it. But what would you like to leave with the Carriage Commentator crew that are listening to this that you have got out of the driving world, apart from your wife and a family and all that sort of thing?
A small bank account, a thin wallet, but great friends, great memories, all with all auctioning, whether it's carriage driving, whether it's plant, whether it's farming, it is something that we feel I personally want to try and leave to the next generation. I hope they still have the interest and the drive and the patience to keep certain traditions going. There is so much that Thimblebees did that we don't do anymore, and it would be a great shame if the carriage sales in particular didn't continue. We are fighting tooth and nail to keep them going, and I would like to see it carry on. I do everything in my power to try and keep it carrying on, and fingers crossed, with the help and support, as I said earlier, of those that know a large amount more than me, we will leave it in people's very capable hands to keep it going on the day when I decide that however many years is enough at TNS and release the reins and let somebody else have a go.
But that's not happening yet, is it?
I can't afford to. I've got a wife that likes horses and carriages.
Thank you, Rich.
That's right.